Next case is 03-1443 Sandra L. Brady Frey, Administratrix versus Toledo Edison Company. Ms. Hasbrook.
Good morning. I'm Denise Hasbrook, and I represent the Toledo Edison Company. I will be standing before you for 10 minutes of our allotted time, and co-defendant Asplund will be taking the remaining 5 minutes. The appellants in this case urge reversal of the appellate court's decision because Camper's activity in this case demonstrates that he primarily assumed the risk of his injuries and voluntarily exposed himself to an obvious or known danger.
Let's stop you right there, because we have, as you know, courts have been writing on primary assumption of risk and implied assumption of risk and comparative negligence and contributory negligence. Maybe this case gives us a chance to maybe perhaps clarify the difference between them. Your statement just put primary assumption of risk in context of looking at it from the standpoint of a perspective of one of the parties. Is that really how we should write the definition?
Your Honor, with the definition that we are advocating, it is a focus on the defendant's, on the activity undertaken by the defendant, and whether he assumed the risk of his injuries, rather than the defendant's conduct. And so in focusing on the activity, in this case, what the defendant did is he worked near an energized power line within 2 to 4 feet of an energized power line that he knew was energized and that he knew was there. This was the conduct and the activity that we focus on rather than the plaintiff's conduct. We're focusing on what did he do on August 6th of 1999. This is an inherently dangerous, lethal activity, and it's one that's incapable of eliminating the risks. This court has observed back in 1943 that power lines are inherently dangerous and the presence of the wires in and of themselves are a warning to the adult population. Without citation to the record, the appellate court in this case found that this risk was inherently dangerous, that the activity that he undertook on August 6, 1999 was inherently dangerous, but then the court found that it was not incapable, the risk was not incapable of being eliminated. We disagree with that statement. Once an individual decides on this activity, which he decided to do, to work near energized power lines, the risk is not capable of being eliminated.
Counsel, if they shut the power line off, it would be.
That focuses on a different activity. His activity in this case was deciding to work near a power line that he knew was there and that he knew was energized. We would submit that this would be a different case. If he thought the power was on or was turned off, but here he knew the power was on, and we know that because after his girlfriend warned him and told him that maybe the power should be shut off, he specifically referred to that power as maybe, honey, I'll see you unless I get electrocuted. So as we are focusing on the activity of the plaintiff, the defendant here, his activity was to voluntarily encounter the risk of an energized power line.
But didn't they try to get the power turned off?
There is evidence in the record that if the facts are construed in favor of the plaintiff, as they must, that a call was made as much as a week before the accident. Nothing between a week
didn't
before.
Did neighbors call the company also on this dangerous condition that they felt was there?
Those issues, at best, demonstrate that calls were made within a week of the accident. But there is no question that on August 6, 1999, and again, focusing on Camphor's activity, that he knew that the power was on. We submit that this would be a different case if for some reason he didn't know the power lines were there, or if he thought the lines had been de-energized. But here he knew, and the conduct that we focus on is the activity on August 6, 1999, and what did Camphor decide to do?
Shouldn't we consider the conduct of the power line and not shutting it off when asked to do so?
That goes into fault and causation. This being an issue of duty, our analysis stops at the duty. And with that analysis, it simply focuses on the conduct of the activity of Camphor in this case.
Okay.
Well, shouldn't it be on the conduct of both parties, not just one?
Your Honor, as this court has recently addressed in Gentry versus Craycraft, which was, of course, in the sporting and recreation context, in that case, it was ruled that, of course, a four-year-old's knowledge or appreciation is not what the court would look at, because by the same token and
different,
by analogy.
Different facts entirely.
They certainly are.
Different, altogether, black and white.
They certainly are.
So
however,
the
analysis of was the activity undertaken by the defendant is the same, and that is, was it inherently dangerous? We would liken it to the open and obvious cases, such as Armstrong versus Best, where once again, the reason we liken it to that case is because that too involves relieving of a duty. And in Armstrong versus Best, in the same manner, the court advised that the Ohio, we should look to and carefully separate the defendant's duty of care with the plaintiff's contributory negligence. If we get into the other issues, and that is negligence per se, as the appellee sets forward, or issues of fault and causation, we've gone past duty. And just like in Armstrong versus Best, where of course the landlord has a general duty of premises liability, that duty is obviated in open and obvious. We submit that this is the opportunity for this court to go back to the duty element that the courts should be stressing. And this is also consistent with what the court noted in the Armstrong case when it relied on footnote 2 of the Simmers case and stated that in adopting the comparative negligence standard, courts should look at the activity and should look at the duty before, of course, it focuses on negligence and causation.
The company has no duty.
The company, of course, has a duty of care that is relieved, just like the open and obvious cases where the landlord, of course, has the premises liability duty.
See, that's where I'm having difficulty with your definition of primary assumption risk. There is a good bit of, as you know, case law, or at least judges have written on it, that indicates that primary assumption of risk means there is absolutely no duty on behalf of the defendant, on the part of the defendant. You don't look to the plaintiff, you look to the defendant's duty. The best simple one to me is somebody breaks into someone's house to rob it and they fall over a toy that's been left in front of the front door. They fall and hit their head on a table or whatever, severe brain damage. Now the robber sues the homeowner. The homeowner has no duty. There's no duty to that robber to protect the robber from injury when he or she enters the house. Isn't that different than this case? Because here you're having to bring the plaintiff in and say, well, now the plaintiff knew this and knew that. Doesn't Toledo Edison have some duty? Whether it was assumed away by the decedent here, that's another issue, but isn't there some duty on the part of Toledo Edison to keep some wires clear of trees? I'm not sure yet which ones they are, but.
Your Honor, generally, of course, the utility company owes the highest duty of care commensurate with the practical application of its business. However, in this case, we would liken it to this court's analysis, again in the sports and recreation context, but in Thompson versus McNeil, where it demonstrated that as the degree of danger increases, of course, the duty decreases until finally it is relieved altogether. And as in this case, Mr. Camphor undertook an inherently dangerous, lethal activity. And so the degree of danger of his conduct and knowing full well, voluntarily, knowing what he was doing, presence of the electrical lines that were energized, the duty decreases until, of course, it is relieved. So it is a duty that
the
is
duty,
relieved.
The duty decreases. How does the duty decrease? By his conduct or by something that the defendant does?
It is by his activity. The focus is on his activity. And of course, in looking at his activity, you look at what he encountered. What was the danger? What was the risk that he encountered?
Did he know he was dealing with a 7,200-volt line?
He certainly knew that the line was energized and that it was dangerous, as evidenced
by his
comment.
There's some evidence that it was similar to a telephone line or a cable line and indistinguishable in terms of observation as to what might have been carried through those wires?
Well, Your Honor, there's also evidence that he discussed with his coworker, Mr. Shufeldt, how to avoid the lines. So he had to have had all lines. He had to have had knowledge that they were dangerous, and also by his own comment on the way out the door. Plus, he did have knowledge and training in electricity. However, that goes in, we believe, to the issues of fault and causation, which we are advocating are not reached here because the duty is relieved by his conscious decision, voluntary decision, to trim anyway near those power lines. That risk is incapable of being eliminated.
Counselor, the issue here, from my reading of the case, is there was a swimming pool, there were some dead branches, and there was a high-powered line of 7,500 volts. Mm-hmm. And I'm not real sure that the voltage matters. You can be electrocuted by something substantially less than 7,500 and have lethal consequences.
Yes, okay. Yes.
All right, so I got the flavor of the case is that they wanted the power company to come there and trim the tree and get rid of these dead branches, and this had been requested for some time, and the power company had not responded in a timely manner according to the neighborhood and this property owner. Am I correct so far?
Yes.
And the decedent then took it upon himself, not because there was a wire dangling or some immediacy or urgency to it, but this was a good day to trim those branches. So there rather than an emergent situation where he had to take care of it right away, this was a choice on his part. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. That is what we are advocating, that voluntary choice is the activity of August 6th of 99 that should be looked at. That activity, to do it today, knowing full well that he may have agreed or disagreed with Toledo Edison's decision to trim trees or cut power, but that day he knew that they didn't do that. He knew that the power was on and then voluntarily and consciously undertook that activity. That activity, you can't eliminate that risk. If you touch the wire, you don't do it somehow safely. If you touch it, you will be hurt or killed. That is so inherently dangerous, such that under the Thompson inverse proportion analysis, it relieves the duty, just like in the open and obvious conduct cases for the landlord, the duty is relieved.
Can you help me? We've taken you well beyond your time, but can you help me with the facts and the brief of Asplund? Is that how that's pronounced?
Asplund.
Asplund. Mm-hmm. They seem to indicate that the decedent here was the trees upon which the dead branches were located were in the neighbor's yard, and that they were next to service lines, which are not the high voltage lines, and that he was out in the alley. I guess this is where I'm not clear. He was in the alley, trying to get to. They make the comment that he was in the alley where you claim that the trees had been trimmed. Asplund says they had been trimmed. Is that where the high voltage wire was? Did it run down the alley or did it cross the property line?
It ran parallel in the alley, and then from the pole there's a service drop that then drops in the home. So at that spot in the alley by that trunk, there's both. There's the parallel lines along the alley, and then there is the service drop, all of which are lethal and dangerous.
Does the utility company have, I assume the utility company doesn't have any obligation to trim trees that are on someone's property. There's a statement that seems to indicate that. Is that correct?
As the service drop comes in, no. The obligations, at least that are addressed in this case through the National Electric Safety Code, are the obligations of the primary conductors, the ones running through the alley. And even that obligation in Section 218 is couched in terms of should, may. It's discretionary with each utility.
Because there's all this, as you know, evidence here about the phone calls to the utility company asking them to come and trim these dead branches, but they had no obligation to do that if they're on the property, on the person's property. Is that correct? Is that what we're saying?
Well, and that's what's missing from the record. I mean, certainly it's pointed out, you know, the specifications, the should and may language of the NESC, but what's not pointed out in the record is what violation was there. And even if these trees were perfectly trimmed that day, it's not going to affect the path of the electricity to ground. That ground is still going to occur. And so that's a bit of a red herring, because the condition of the trees around, it's no more relevant and maybe relevant to his motive, but motive doesn't matter any more than why the little boys in Gentry decided to pound nails in their backyard. That goes to his motive, and that's all. It wouldn't have eliminated his risk, because the electricity is still going to flow, whether trees are trimmed around it or not. Thank you.
Thank you. That was, use 10 minutes. Mr. Tice, you want to take the time now? Okay.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Donald Tice, and I'm here. I represent Aspen Tree Expert Company. I have 5 minutes. Hopefully, I can cover this within the 5 minutes. I look upon this case. It presents to court the opportunity, as you, Chief Justice, noted, to say affirm or to clarify the principle of primary assumption of risk, our position is, as it applies in a non-recreational situation. This court has recently addressed open and obvious in the Armstrong case. It has addressed primary assumption risk in a recreational sporting activity involving minors in Gentry versus Craycroft. And also we note in Roman versus the state of Gobble, it addressed the issue of sudden medical emergency. We note in this case, appellee is not contesting or challenging that primary assumption of risk should not be available as a defense in the state of Ohio. What we're looking at is, in terms of, as the court expressed this morning, say what would be the appropriate framework for espousing and promulgating the doctrine of primary assumption of risk. And we look at it, it goes back to the Anderson case, where the court recognized and acknowledged primary assumption of risk as a separate defense. This court in Gallagher versus Cleveland Brown also discussed primary assumption of risk, although it was in the context of a waiver. Justice Stratton in Goldfuss versus Davison addressed the idea of perhaps primary assumption of risk to be applied in a criminal context. And then we have, as Attorney Hasbrook alluded to, the recent case of Gentry versus Craycraft. What we're looking at in terms of the legal framework is primarily Anderson and Gallagher, and plus Gentry regarding the level of conduct that was discussed in that case. And looking at Anderson, it defined the defense of assumption risk as comprised of three elements. One, consent or acquiescent in, number two, an appreciated or known, number three, risk. This court in Anderson also noted, though, primary assumption risk, or I should say assumption of risk, it's also applicable where the risk is so obvious that a plaintiff must have known and appreciated it. So the distinction between assumption of risk and contributory negligence is a matter of knowledge of the danger and an intelligent acquiescence in it, and that's stated by the court in Anderson. In Gallagher, this court, in citing the Cincinnati Baseball Club versus Eno case, made us a little caveat and narrowed the field of primary assumption of risk as we see the case, and that is primary assumption of risk is there only for those risks directly associated with the activity in question. So you have a harm directly related to the activity involved.
Counsel, you've cited a whole bunch of cases that I dissented in all of them, so. You haven't said anything that persuasive to me yet. Let me take you to the facts. The chief just ask you, because you're here representing the tree trimming
Correct, Your Honor.
Company. The problem tree or the dead branches, were they hanging over the drop, or were they, was there some possibility that they could fall? And by the drop, I assume that is meant the line coming from the transformer on into the house.
If I can briefly describe the scene, you have the alleyway running this way, and that is where the primary and secondary lines of Toledo Edison lie, and that is what Asbun trimmed. You have coming off of those lines a house service drop line that goes to a neighboring house. You have two trees involved in the situation. One is in the neighbor's yard, one tree in which the plaintiff expert himself said that would be the responsibility to take care of that tree, belongs to the homeowner or somebody. Then you have the trees in Toledo Edison's right of way that that day of this accident, the decedent decided to get to this tree, we need to put our skylift out here, a skylift he had rented for another job in Sandusky, but is convenient to have it here. And while the process of taking out limbs in this tree to get to this tree in the neighbor's yard is when this fatal accident took place.
So the tree that concerned him had limbs that needed trimmed that were over the active Toledo Edison lines, not over the drop line.
The tree limbs that the decedent was concerned about was the neighbor's tree in which the branch, one in particular, went very close to the house service drop line, and that's the limbs that went over the pool. But to get to that tree, the decision was made to come in through the alley and go through those trees.
So he was cutting tree limbs that were already serviced by Ashplund?
He was cutting trees along Toledo Edison's easement or right-of-way that had been trimmed less than a year earlier by Asbun, correct.
Okay.
But not that tree in the backyard.
He was trimming those to get to the trees he was trying to get to.
Exactly. Yeah. In looking at the question in terms of framework for primary assumption or risk, we think
you,
the first
you
question-
You need to sum up. You've already had 20 minutes by our new system here.
Okay.
Great.
I was just going to say, in terms of three questions, the first one would be, what is the risk involved here is inherently dangerous? The second question would be, based upon Gallagher, would the injury, was the injury a direct result of the specific risk involved? With it being an inherent risk, by the way, that would take care of elements 2 and 3 to what's been defined by the Anderson Court, leaving only the element whether the plaintiff consented or acquiesced in assuming that risk. And then finally would be, whether the conduct, say if you want to look at the defendant's conduct, whether it's more than negligence, but say wanton or recklessness or intentional.
As is it your view that this doctrine applies when there is no duty, or is it your view that the assumption of risk relieves the defendant of a duty?
Our position, based upon that, in terms of a duty of due care, that if primary assumption risk would apply, that would preclude the plaintiff from establishing a duty of negligence or due care, and or relieves the defendant of any duty of due care, of negligence. Again, that separates it from the case that this court had discussed in Gentry, where you talk about maybe reckless conduct or intentional conduct, something that would not be expected. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Blumensteel.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jim Blumensteel, and I represent the estate of Steve Camphor. First, to clear up one issue that was raised, this wasn't a tree limb that was near a line. This was a dead branch, 4 to 6 inches big, that was bowing the line down 3 feet from the pool.
In the neighbor's yard.
The tree was in the neighbor's yard. No, yeah. This was in Steve Camphor's yard. It went right over.
But do you disagree that with the plaintiff's expert that the obligation to trim a tree in one's yard, own yard, versus the alleyway here, is the obligation of the homeowner or the property owner?
I disagree both. That was an evidentiary statement, and I disagree with it as a conclusion of law. It is the duty of Toledo Edison, and they can delegate it on to Aspen, but they're still responsible.
So you're saying utility has the obligation.
Utility has
the
obligation.
Let me ask the question. Sure. To trim every tree in everyone's yard?
No.
Okay, why this one?
This was a tree that was 9 wires were running through it. telephone wires, TV wires, 120-volt wires, and unbeknownst to anybody in the neighborhood, a distribution line with 7,200 volts on it.
No, I thought they said, I thought the facts were that, I'm just going to keep testing the facts.
Sure,
important here.
Sure, glad to.
I thought the facts were from Asplund that the high voltage wire ran down the alley, not through the yard. Is that not your understanding?
The high voltage wire ran down the easement in the alley through the tree. The service drop came off the distribution line.
The tree, not the tree that was the offending tree, but the tree.
The
okay,
tree.
So we have a difference in the interpretation.
The tree
facts.
From which a dead branch had broken earlier and knocked down a fence, a similar tree that the lines ran through that had a dead branch caused by the electricity coursing through.
Counselor,
those branches.
Was this on private property or in the easement? The tree you're talking about, because you're confusing me.
Easement.
It was in the easement. The dead branch.
Up.
Was on a tree that was located in the easement, not on private property.
Right. The easement is the area where the lines run, and the lines ran through the tree.
And the utility company has the duty to trim those trees that run in the easement.
Yes, Your Honor. They have the statutory duty. They have the duty under the regulations of the National Electric Safety Code. They have the duty under their own guidelines that said that 7,200 volts should have been protected 10 feet on each side, 15 foot on the bottom, and 12 feet above. Clear.
Were you trimming, there's been, again, the facts are getting more confused, I think. Were you trimming the tree in the easement to get to the tree in the yard?
It was the same tree.
Yeah.
They were trimming branches to move closer. There's a fence. They were on the opposite side of the fence. They were working their way, taking 3 to 4 foot branches, lowering it down to the ground, cutting another branch, getting ultimately to the branch that he called even before they put the pool in, saying, it's a dead branch leaning on the
okay,
service
let me,
line.
Let me backtrack.
Sure.
You're trimming the tree that's in the yard, but the tree in the yard reaches into the easement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you trimming a tree, the dead tree that was in the yard? Is that the one that was being trimmed when the power line was touched, or are you trimming a different tree in the easement?
No, I'm saying the tree that was in the easement where the lines ran through spread in an area almost as big as this courtroom.
Okay. I mean,
it was a huge tree.
But
because
what?
Excuse me.
Why were you trying to get to another tree?
No, trying to get to the dead branch. The dead branch was bowing the service line down
and
within
what,
3 feet.
And what tree did that dead branch attach to?
The tree that they were trimming, the tree through which the 7,200, the television cables.
Is there what is this tree that's in the yard that's hanging over the pool? Is there a separate tree or is there only one tree that we're talking
it's
about?
It's a tree that's actually two properties down that spread. Now you keep in mind, this is in a very poor section of Toledo, very small lots, and it's spread over into his area. And the wires are the responsibility by contract, by statute, and by NESC regulations for them to trim, including dead branches. Their own guidelines say a dead branch that is a hazard to our conductor, we must take down. Everybody in this
Let me change the facts just right. A little. If the Toledo Edison had said, we're going to come out on Tuesday,
okay,
and we're going to shut the wires, shut the line off, and you can trim it to your heart's content on Tuesday, we're going to shut the wires down.
Okay.
And your client decides to do it on Sunday and not wait till Tuesday. What is your position as to what the legal liabilities are?
If you take all the facts in where he called before he put the pool in, he called for a year, he got the neighbors to call for the better part of a year, and there are 7 months of records missing for these trouble calls that just happened to precede the call that he said, turn it off, I'll trim it if you won't come out. It is Toledo Edison's duty, irrespective of
so
any of the
your position is that even if they said we are shutting it on Tuesday and he chooses to do it on Sunday, it's still comparative, not assumption of risk.
When you analyze, and I think Judge Moyer here was talking about that, when you analyze the plaintiff's conduct in this situation, you are in implied assumption of risk. You are into comparative negligence, and you talk about all
so
of
So your
the
answer
facts.
Is it's comparative even if he knew they were going to cut the power?
Right.
Okay.
Knowledge is the important thing here, and I want people to understand that this was a myriad of lines running through a tree, 9 of them. Nobody knew what they were. But nobody in this case had any concept that there were 7,200 volts. All experts, defendants' experts and plaintiffs' experts alike, agreed that if you thought it was 120, they were going to be protected. They had rubber-soled shoes on. They had rubber outriggers on the two-man lift. They had rubber tires. 120 is nothing. There was no danger in their mind. If there was any understanding, Toledo Edison had a long time to tell them every time these people called, say, be aware, there's 7,200 volts. Nobody told the neighbors that when they called. Nobody told Steve Camphor that when they called. They had the duty to tell them what was up there when they were delaying for a whole year to trim this.
Counselor, you're saying that they had a duty to tell them that there was 7,200 volts there. Every time, are you saying that your client, your client's decedent, said, I'm going to trim this myself? Every time there was a complaint made to Toledo Edison, I'm going to take action, I'm going to take activity into my own hands?
No. When Steve Camphor called just a week before and said, you've ignored us for a year, will you please turn off the electricity? I'll trim it for you, because I've got kids and I'm worried. If that branch comes down, like the other branches in that same tree had come down, and killed one of his kids or his kids' friends, there's a father that could never live with that burden. He was given a choice of two evils. He didn't know there was 7,200. Little Ron Schufeld, 18-year-old boy, up there with him. If there was any recognition of a high voltage like that, he would have told Ron Schufeld. Ron said, we thought we were totally safe. We never dreamed anything like this could happen. There wasn't any knowledge. If there's no knowledge, then you cannot assume the risk of something you have no knowledge
about. Counsel, my sense is that there is still some confusion among us about the nature of the tree, because counsel for the power company implied that there were several trees involved. My understanding from your description is that there was one large tree. Is that correct?
That was involved with this particular event.
Yes.
Yes.
And what kind of a tree was that?
I think it was a box elder, big one.
Okay, so it's
fast-growing.
Soft wood.
Soft wood, easy to, as the expert said, that limb was likely to go.
And the limb that concerned your client, the dead limb, was hanging over and bowing down the service line.
Pushing it right down. Had been for years.
Right. But there were other limbs on the same tree that were reaching out into the alley and into the high tension.
Surrounding nine wires, including above the high tension, 7,200 volt. That's why the experts have testified, that's why this limb was dead, because it had 7,200 volts coursing through part of this tree. Mm-hmm. So the other issue, knowledge, he had no knowledge that there was 7,200. You can't assume the risk of something you do not know. And the other thing that's important is there was no voluntariness. There was no venturesomeness to this. Here was a man scared to death about all the kids. He put it together. He had custody of his children. He's a divorced 35-year-old poor man trying to make a living.
All right, counsel, let me bring you back to the tree. Sure. We understand, you know, who the decedent was here. The trunk of that tree, the base, the roots, were on the easement or they were in on private property?
Easement, and it doesn't matter.
Wait a minute, just answer, okay. The easement. And that was, the testimony was that that was trimmed a year before that.
That was the assertion by Aspen. They had a contract that was supposed to have been completed in June of 1998. They did not do the alley, and Toledo Edison did not inspect the alley.
So it's in the easement.
It wasn't trimmed.
It's in the easement. They claim that they trimmed it a year before. There is, however, a decaying or dead branch of that tree that is over private property. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And your contention, and you say the standards are, that they should have made whatever arrangements to enter on private property or from the alley, if able, and eliminate that branch.
Their own guidelines, that is what they had the obligation to do. That is what the state statute says they had the obligation to do. That's what the National Electric Safety Code said they had the obligation to do.
To clear this up,
sure.
The utility company routinely comes on private property to trim any trees that are involved in
wires.
I mean, that's as plain
Absolutely.
As I can make it.
Yes.
that is nothing unusual.
If there's any concern that somebody might be upset, they have to go to the house. They didn't do any of that. They did not do the trimming, and Toledo Edison paid a bunch of money and didn't even bother to inspect. The whole alley was not trimmed, period.
Is it a question of whether they have a duty to do that or whether they do it for goodwill?
Oh, no, no. There is.
The reason we're having confusion is because in Asplund's reply brief, this statement is made on page 4. Lastly, two different trees are involved. One tree was in the alley that one camper was trimming when he came into contact with the electrical line. Camper was trimming this tree to get to a second tree located in his neighbor's backyard whose branch was close to a service or house drop line. It was the limb in the neighbor's backyard tree near the house drop line that was of concern to Camper, the decedent, of course, and which is beyond the scope of the tree trimming contract between Asplund and Toledo Edison. Well, that's the contract. But then Appley's or plaintiff's electrical engineer expert acknowledges the removal of this neighbor's tree branch or fixing the situation would be the responsibility and expense of the homeowner, property owner, or Camper. Now, that may be an error. But that's why we're having this. That's why I'm having a problem, because
I can understand.
Why was it in the alley? Do you agree with everything except the expert's opinion?
Right.
With that statement? How the event occurred?
All of the documents are in there as far as their statutory, their regulatory duties, and their own contractual duties and their own guidelines. And where there is a dead branch that is a danger to the conductor, they are to take it down. This was a dead branch leaning on a conductor, and they were to take it down. They were to take the steps. They had a year in which to do it. I've listed all the duties. The violation is they never came out. The violation is they never trimmed. The violation is they never inspected. They have 7 months of records that are missing. We talk about primary, express, implied, and secondary assumption of risk. But let's talk about primary. The Supreme Court here has time and time again dealt with baseball games, football games, where there is no duty. You can't change the rules of baseball. You have to hit the ball hard to win the game. There were ample duties listed in this brief. Let's look at it this way. If after a year to a year and a half of all the neighbors and Steve Camford calling Toledo Edison to trim this dead branch off the service line, and that branch did fall, as branches on that very tree had done before, and a kid was killed in that pool right 3 feet away from it, is there anybody here that would really seriously contend that Toledo Edison did not have a duty to that child that was killed in the pool? I do not think so. This is an implied assumption of risk. He didn't voluntarily go up there. The Hammer case and the Mizzen case and the Danner case all go, if you're faced with a choice of two evils, and you make that choice, and there is an injury because you made the choice, the defendants cannot duck responsibility because they put you in that position. They put Steve Camphor in that position, and he ended up dying because of it. This case doesn't even need the distinction between primary, express, implied. It goes to two things. Was there evidentiary dispute as to whether or not he had full knowledge and appreciation of the 7,200 volts? There was no evidence whatsoever that he had any concept that there was 7,200 volts. And there's no dispute 120 was going to be no danger to it. If there's a lack of knowledge or appreciation, then it's a jury issue for them to decide. Likewise, the third prong of Beyer-Lathrop case is voluntariness. And this is where the Hammond and the Danner and the Mizen case comes in. If you're forced to make a choice, a hard choice, which he did, and he'd rather make that choice with him running the risk than his children running the risk, then, under that circumstance, there is a dispute as to whether or not this was voluntary. And if there's a dispute as to whether or not it was fully voluntary, it is a jury issue. The argument of the defendant appellants is inherent danger, therefore you should apply primary assumption of risk. That's not what inherent danger's definition is. It's those inherent dangers, such as baseball and football, that cannot be altered by ordinary care. The proof that ordinary care could easily have prevented this tragedy is if they had just responded to one of their telephone calls and gone out and trimmed with them. That's all they had to do, like they did the day after his funeral. That's how easy. That's the ordinary care that could have remedied this inherent danger. There is evidence that they violated their duty, evidence that they were intentionally reckless, evidence no knowledge, of not voluntariness, active participation under the Hirschbeck cases. Think of that. They had the active participation of a trouble call line that they did not respond to. And all of their experts said this tree should have been removed, and it was a day later. If they actively participate, then assumption of risk is not a defense. Likewise, if Toledo Edison had a reasonable expectation of danger under the Hill and Bullock cases, it's a question of fact for the jury. It is not a matter to be dismissed. If in spite of Toledo Edison's highest standard of care, statutory duty to trim, regulatory duty to trim, contractual duty, and their own standards and guidelines that are all in the record, if in spite of all those duties, the court were to apply primary assumption risk in this case, it would do away with Toledo Edison's need for a trouble line. It would do away with their need to trim trees. It would do away with expensive contracts of Asplund to hire them to trim the trees for them. They could ignore the statutory regulations, ignore the NESE regulations, and more importantly, the highest degree of care would evolve downward into no degree of care. In essence, you would have a public utility without responsibility. This is a fact-driven case. This case should not, with all due respect, shouldn't be here except for perhaps clarifying the definition of primary, secondary, express, etc. But it's a fact-driven case, and it should have been sent back to trial court, and we're asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and remand the case to the trial court.
The utility company certainly had knowledge that of the voltage of that wire. They, of all people, would know that.
Absolutely. And that's why I say, when he called and said, turn off the electricity, 1 week before, and they refused, at least they should have armed him with that information and said, hey, pal, don't go up there, 7,200 volts. And if he knew that, Ron Shufeldt would have heard it. He was standing right next to him, and nobody had any concern of any electricity beyond 120. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Blumensteel. Ms. Hasbrook, you've used well over your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Counsel, wouldn't it be true that your company has the right to go on any private property and trim or cut down any tree that interferes with the electric running through your lines?
And that would be for the primary lines.
Right.
The company does not take easements for secondary, the drops into the home.
For the drops.
And that is what, right.
But for the primary lines, private property or not, you can go anywhere and take down a tree or trim a tree that's interfering with your primary lines. And in fact, after the parent of your company for not keeping the lines off and causing the brownout all over North America.
Well, I really can't comment on. However, the company does take easements. It does take easements, and that is what permits the lawful entry. Not that that translates to a duty. I mean, that permits the lawful entry. Of course, there are duties here, but not the duty of what a homeowner dictates to the company. Trim that tree. I'd like to have that tree down because it's cheaper, because now I don't have to hire a contractor, because now I don't have to do it. That's not the duty.
That's not the facts of this case.
Well, in this case, he was concerned about the secondary drop. That is what the phone call said. And in our view, that is the homeowner's responsibility to do at their cost.
What's at the far end of the secondary drop? Not the home end, but the other end.
The primary running parallel.
Okay, and if the limb comes down on the drop end of the house and tears it down, what's the risk then? Isn't there a risk to the primary line?
They have disconnects that. Are you asking, would the primary line come down in that event?
Well, will it touch?
It's not necessarily. I mean, it could dangle. I mean, if there's a risk to the public, certainly 120 volts is a risky and it is an inherently dangerous line as well.
Now, I'm asking, would it touch, could it touch the primary lines?
Theoretically, it could. It doesn't always. It could just fall on the ground.
Counselor, the facts that were considered by the trial court for the granting of the summary judgment, were there one tree or two? I'm still confused about this discrepancy in the description of the configuration of the trees here.
There is one tree with one base in the neighbor's yard, branches that go out into all yards, including the primary.
Including the primary, the easement, the alley?
Yes, because okay. The tree is large, as Mr. Blumensteel said. Now, there is a second tree nearby that Asplin did trim on its trip up the alley. According to the company's specifications, and it still stands by the fact that that's what needed to be done. That's where I believe the second tree issue came in, because in looking at this, they did not believe and still do not believe that it was an encroachment, that it was a problem with these lines.
So the trial court considered the fact that the decedent was trimming branches from the second tree in order to get to the tree with the damaged or with the dead limb. Is that correct?
No, I believe the trial court was looking that he was trimming the tree in the neighbor's yard, but the limbs went over onto his yard. The trial court, I believe, in discussing the second tree, was talking about the tree that Asplin actually did trim in 1998. Camphor just disagreed. He thought they should have caught both of the trees, but according to the specs and specifications, the company doesn't agree, nor does it agree every time a homeowner comes out and says, remove that tree.
So was this a tree on private property whose branches were extending into the alley and the power lines were going through this private, in essence, a private tree with branches into the public easement?
That's exactly it. The trunk is on private property, but it goes into the airspace of the easement that in the back alley.
And Asplin did not trim that part of the tree that was over the easement that the lines were running through, or did they?
It did not touch this tree because it has a circle around the lines that FERC talks about that needs to be cleared away, so many feet away from those lines, depending on the voltage. And this, Mr. Camphor disagreed, but this tree did not meet the minimum criteria of the trim. The one next to it, that's where we get into a second tree, was touched by Asplin because it did meet the criteria.
All right, last question. Was there any warning on any of the poles supporting the primary line? Warning, 7,200 volts along the alleyway.
No, but this court has found in Hetrick versus Marion Reserve that the presence of the high tension lines in and of themselves are a warning to the adult population of the danger, and in the Ott case versus Dayton Power and Light, it is not strict liability. No is the answer to your question.
So you disagree, and this is interesting because this is a summary judgment. I'm becoming more and more convinced summary judgment wasn't appropriate here, I guess, when I hear all these different facts. But because Asplin says one tree was in the alley, the one Camphor, the decedent, was trimming when he came into contact with the Toledo Edison electric line. Camphor was trimming this tree to get to a second tree. Now, you just indicated that it was the first tree, or the tree on the private property that was hanging over, had grown over into the alley that was being trimmed. But that's not what the tree experts, the tree trimming person says in their brief.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.